There we go.
We're basically live. Not really live, but...
Nah, I get it.
So, Jonathan, I want to start with saying thanks two times. Three times, actually. So, first of all, thanks for being insane enough to come here on, you know, like, with very little knowledge about what it is.
Yeah, it was a challenging trip to get here, but it's been a very good trip.
Yeah, it took a couple landing attempts and a couple days delay, but that's how Madeira is. It's a crazy airport. The second thanks goes to agreeing to do this. Go on the record to talk FIPS, and I'm going to grill you about FIPS a little bit and about your Sorbonne engineering experience. And third of all, thanks for building FIPS in the first place. It
sure.
was very much needed, I think.
Yeah, the response has been very gratifying. You know, it's, I mean, I've been in the open source community for a very long time, but I had kind of forgotten what it was like, you know, when you produce something and other people pick it up and start doing things on their own with it that, like, you didn't tell them to go do.
Yeah.
You know, and you realize, like, wow, you know, other people actually think this is worth investing their own time and energy into. And so... You know, the response here at SEC has been incredible. The demo days so far, you know, the 2 weeks that we've had, you know, and the one that we have tomorrow have been mostly FIPS oriented. And, you know, I wasn't expecting that when I did it, but the pent up demand and the, you know, the need that FIPS fills with this group has been pretty high.
What were you expecting when you built it? Why did you build it in the first place?
Well, it was a challenge to solve. Which kind of sounds funny, but, you know, when I was at the Noster event in Costa Rica, Arjen, you know, mentioned that, hey, here's a problem we need to solve, and here's kind of the outlines of it, and, you know, we want to have a way to have networking that doesn't require permission from central authorities, that doesn't have, you know, the problems where someone can just, like, yank a domain name or whatever. And I thought, well, you know, I think I know how to solve this, but I'm not sure. And so I went away for like a month after Costa Rica. And I think Arjen thought that like I had forgotten all about it. and I thought, well, I think I know how to do this. And it was just, you know, like an intense amount of thinking and design and then programming, you know, to come out with it. And, you know, he kept telling me they're going to love this. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, that's good to hear. I just didn't know sort of the breadth of interest.
Yeah.
And that, you know, Cobrador told me that, you know, I didn't think this would exist for 10 more years, you know. And now I have it in my hands.
Yeah, like you say, there was a lot of pent-up demand. And it kind of, we went full circle because, and it's what you mentioned also a couple days ago, basically, Cobrador, by implementing Tollgate, and he has a weird way of thinking about these things because he has a very weird background, right? It's like, how can you make this work in like an Indian hippie commune of 2,000 people and sell internet by the packet, you know? Like that's his big
dream,
vision, basically.
Right. Well, he may see it.
and he kind of got Arjen in the mix, and then Arjen and you had this interaction, and then you locked yourself in the cellar for a month. Like that's how all good software projects are born, right?
Sure.
Like that's how Git came to be and so on. And then you came back and again, like you actually joined for Sorbonne Engineering, which is amazing to bring it to the group. And to me, what's interesting is that FIPS kind of in some way turns networking on its head. And now we are back to the early days of networking again, right?
Sure. Like, yeah, we're trying to figure out, you know, how does the scale, how, you know, what are the problems with it? You know, how do you break it? How do you respond to bad actors trying to sabotage it? You know, there's all these things that are, you know, sort of swirling in the air that the regular internet, you know, was dealing with 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah. And the solution was mostly authority based, right?
Like, yeah.
And I think that's the challenge at hand. How do we solve the same problems? It's still the same problems, but without reintroducing a central authority that can rock.
Yeah, I mean, so from a purely engineering point of view, you know, FIPS nodes, you know, are, you know, not to be too cliche, but they're completely peers with each other. So there's no way to enforce anything except what you enforce on your node. So you have to set the software up in a way that if they all cooperate, it works great. But if someone isn't cooperating by doing like the same protocol, the impact of it is limited to their, you know, the blast radius is limited to their small region. And that's kind of a difficult tension. There are a lot of things in FIPS that would be a lot easier from a technical point of view if there was a top-down authority.
It's always easier.
You know, but that would just be, you know, following the same path we followed 30 years ago.
What is the best demo you saw building on FIPS in the last 2 weeks? What surprised you most?
Well, so this one's kind of funny. Satson Sports designed a transport for FIPS, and in FIPS a transport is a way for two nodes to communicate. It could be over the internet, it could be directly over Ethernet or Bluetooth or, you know, Tor or over a serial connection. You know, the node abstraction is independent of all those. So he actually built a transport that could talk over Noster.
Nice.
So it was literally sending packets up to relays, down from the relay to another node, as if it was an IP network, and like, you know, his ping times were measured in seconds.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But it worked.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, wildly impractical and kind of crazy. But it
just shows that FIPS doesn't care about the underlying transport
layer. It does. And actually, the thing that it proved out was that with these long delays, it just works still.
Yeah.
You know, like the everything works on the happy path, and you've got 2 milliseconds latency and all that. You know, if that's all you touch, then when you try to do something more strenuous, it breaks.
Yeah.
And, you know, his little demo was something that was like a existence proof that the protocol was a little bit more robust.
Yeah. That's awesome. What's still on the roadmap for you? Let's walk up there a little bit, and then there's a nice bench where we can
sit
down a bit.
Sure.
So what's still on the roadmap for you? More battle testing?
Yeah, well, so in this round with FIPS, you know, it's like what I call a dancing bear. It's not that the bear dances very well, it's that he can dance at all. And, you know, FIPS is working great. You know, we have 150 nodes connected right now on the test net. And
which is quite amazing in and of itself. Like, that's way, way more than I would have guessed.
Yeah, I was surprised to see the growth. But, you know, this was a way of learning what worked and what didn't. I had put quite a few features in this first release that I was not sure that they were necessary. You know, things to do with like measuring protocol statistics and whatnot. And so now that, you know, I have a better sense of what, you know, where the load-bearing parts of FIPS are, I'm going through a next stage where, you know, the protocol negotiation between nodes doesn't just assume like it's, you know, fixed format, and if you want to change it, it breaks everybody and all of that. So I'm going through a redesign where I can get rid of the pieces that don't matter, you know, and hardening some things that needed hardening, or like anticipating, okay, we know how things operate at 150 nodes. What do I need to put it into it to operate at 1,500 or 15,000 nodes?
So
we're going to be coming out with a release maybe in a couple of weeks. That's the first version of that. And you won't really see any changes in features, but it's kind of like the foundation is now solid.
Yeah, I see.
Instead of being like there and working, but like rickety.
Yeah. In terms of contributions, what would be the most helpful, you think?
Actually, testing.
So just running it and connecting to stuff and just playing around with it, basically?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a network engineer. If I can get ping to work, you know, my job is done. But the guys at SEC here, I mean, we've got a port to Windows 32, we've got a port to Mac, we've got a port to FreeBSD. Somebody has got it working in WebAssembly inside a browser.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
And, you know, it's just like, these are all things that prove out, you know, it can operate in different environments. And there aren't, like, fundamental new features. You know, what I guess what I really want is try to break it so that we can fix it. Because if we don't break it, somebody else is going to. And they may not have the same intentions that we have.
Yeah, I see.
You know.
Yeah. And how was...
No, I won't sound so out of breath. This is Madeira after all. Everything's uphill.
Everything's uphill. Everything's... You know, it's like the Bitcoin roller coaster guy.
Yeah.
It goes like this.
Exactly.
But we have nice views. Like, that's the nice thing about climbing a hill. Like, you get nice views.
Oh, least. It's fantastic here.
Yeah. How were the last, like, almost 3 weeks for you? What did you expect coming here, and how was it different from what you expected?
Well, I think the Costa Rica event sort of like paved the way, because it was the first conference. There was like 40 Nostr developers in one space, and I had not encountered that kind of vibe in like 3 decades. Mm. You know, when I was originally involved with the Cypherpunk group in Silicon Valley in the early 90s, it was that same freedom tech, self-sovereign, you know, don't try to fight the system, bypass it.
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
Build a new one and leave the old one behind, and let the old one do what it's going to do for whatever, you know, better or for worse. But, you know, opt out and build your own alternative system. And a lot of stuff came out of that group, you know, in the early days. And then in the Bitcoin days, in the early, you know, 2010, when I was involved, it was the same idea. You know, we were focusing almost entirely on the payment rails, you know, economic part of the problem. But, you know, all the other privacy issues still existed, and they were even worse. Mm. The Nostr community, and then now here at the Sovereign Engineering subset of that, has been very refreshing to see that young people today are picking up the mantle of, you know, this kind of fight of not changing the system, but building a new one and opting out of the old one.
Yeah.
And doing it in ways that really can't be stopped. The tools today to accomplish that are much better.
Yeah.
I mean, especially now with agentic tooling. But, you know, I don't think that Nostr itself would have been possible 30 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah,
or even in the 2010s of Bitcoin era. It's been rejuvenating for an old guy like me to interact with, you know, all these young people that are earnest and trying to do the right thing, and maybe they don't have all the history, or maybe they don't have all of the experience or knowledge, but, you know, that's what they'll get by doing all this.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, what we have on the it's to me, it's not very surprising that, like, Nostr is full of Bitcoin people, because you need to be able to handle keys, for example. You know?
Sure.
And Bitcoin prepares you for that. Most people are not fine with handling key material. Like,
yeah, well,
it's a hard
and,
thing
and,
to do.
And some people will never be fine with that. You know, custodial solutions that provide the solution to that you know, will always exist.
Yeah.
And, you know, people will decide their risk tolerance for how they want to handle their money.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the consequences of losing control of your NPUB are a little bit less than losing control of your UTXOs.
Very true.
But still, it exists.
Yeah.
And, in fact, I think in the last cohort, the issue of, you know, identity and, you know, key revocation and key rotation was the subject of the last one.
Yeah.
And I have some thoughts on that, but I'm not well educated in, like, what everyone has already tried and decided doesn't work. So I've got to go look at the, you know, the captain's reports from the last one and read all about that. That also came up in Costa Rica. There was a big group that was interested in the dealing with NPUBs and secret keys and all of that in a more robust way.
I'm quite confident that this will be solved. It's just going to take time. And in terms of, like, you know, there's no real top-down structure, so you can't force it on all the clients and all those kind of things. It just has to emerge organically.
And that's the way everything is solved. Nobody comes out with solutions that work the first time. You know, it's a Darwinian process. You know, you'll get 100 different variations on a theme, and maybe 5 of them will work well. And the rest will go in the dustbin. And, you know, you'll have a set of solutions, and then people will pick like one that they like, and the network effect will take over from there. Mm. So I don't think anybody, even, you know, you think of the modern internet and, you know, how rigid it is. You know, it didn't become this whole, you know, fully formed, you know, in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
You know, built in incremental steps to deal with problems that emerged as it got bigger and bigger. And some solutions, you know, the classic one is the 7-layer OSI stack model.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like,
which
that
is,
was
like, hallucination, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the standards body imposed, you know, this is how it's going to be. Yeah. And everyone just kind of thumbed their nose at them and said no.
Yeah, I learned that in school, by the way.
Yeah.
Like I had to learn the whole 7-layer stack by heart.
And the first 3 layers made sense. And you know,
doesn't matter if it matches reality.
All protocols, you know, have physical layers and MAC layers and network transport layers. But then above that, it gets really murky, and the rest of that was just a fantasy of some people on a committee.
Yeah.
And, you know, that'll happen with Nostr as well.
I agree. You mentioned that the tooling is better today. What can you say about kind of what other stuff is different when you compare it to the early cypherpunk movement or the early Bitcoin movement in terms of, I don't know, like culture or, I don't know, like state of the world or... You mentioned you see lots of similarities, but I would be interested, like, how is it different?
Well, you probably won't like my answer.
That's fine.
So with enthusiasm comes sort of short attention spans.
Yeah.
And, you know, this just may be the old guy and me talking again, but in earlier epochs of this movement, there was a lot more academic structure behind it.
Yeah.
You know, so all the early cryptography...
They all came from academia, right?
Yeah. The early 70s, or the late 70s with RSA and Diffie-Hellman and, you know, the hardening of symmetric cryptography, you know, from like triple DES to, you know, newer and newer versions that work better. You know, that was strongly academically focused. And people in groups like the cypherpunks, you know, had computer science backgrounds. Yeah. You know, they were not necessarily academics from a, you know, their career was, you know, working in academia at a university publishing papers, but more like they were coming at it from having been educated in, you know, what today we would just call STEM.
Yeah, rigorous academic training.
But much more rigor involved in pursuing ideas and writing them up and, you know, the critiques and the, you know, fortunately, you know, the expression that's still well known today is, you know, rough consensus and running code.
Yeah.
You know, so code trumped everything. If you had something that, you know, worked and you had code that did it, then a lot of the fluff behind it sort of didn't matter. You know, so you could talk about a protocol all day long, but if you had something working, you know, that lent it credibility because people could, you know, pick the code apart and find out what was real and what wasn't. In Nostr and SEC, what I have seen is very earnest, well-meaning people trying to do the right thing, but not necessarily taking the time to do, you know, what I still think is the necessary step of engineering, design, and review, and making sure the design is right before you even attempt to implement it. And, you know, my snarky joke of shower thought to Zap Store in 6 hours.
Yeah,
you know, is meant to be triggering to people, but
it's very true. I mean, I think it's a good thing and a bad thing. You know, it's like it's like for some things you might strike gold with a shower thought to Zap Store in 6 hours. You know?
Well, I mean, there's nothing stopping you from doing that, and that's you know, that when I say the tools, I mean the ability to disseminate an idea today is vastly better than it was back then. You had mailing lists, you know, we didn't have, you know, Discord.
Yeah, everything was slower.
We didn't have Nostr.
Yeah.
Everything was slower, and so you had time to be more deliberate about things.
Yeah.
And now...
Which is also a feature in some sense, right? Like, because if things are slow and require friction, you really need to want it, right? Like the idea, it's a filter in some sense. So only the most stubborn people and the best ideas come through in some sense.
Sure.
So you don't drown in noise as much. I think that's part of the issue today, that we're drowning in noise in general.
Sure. So I agree with that. And that's not just an SEC or an Nostr thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so I say those things, you know, in a kind of a snarky way. you know, because I earnestly do think that Noster could benefit from a little bit more slower pace of deliberate development and design, you know, ahead of time. But that doesn't mean that, I mean, you can just do things as the, the expression. You know, we have thousands of people working on stuff that they think is important, and you know, they're putting it out there for other people. And they're doing it for free. It's a gift of their time and energy, you know, to the world. And you can't say there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look at the volume today versus 30 or 40 years ago, it's vastly larger.
Yeah.
You know, so the output of new things today is tremendous. You know, it also means that the tail extends very far.
Yeah.
You know, so you get some really bad stuff and you get some really good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't want that to stop.
Yeah.
I just sometimes get the feeling, especially when I talk to, you know, normies, so to speak, who look at Noster for the first time, and a common thing that I hear is it looks half-baked. It looks half-finished. It looks like things are kind of slow and mostly work, but I'm just going to go back to Twitter because, you know, it shows up instantly on my screen. And then you have to, like, explain why, you know, maybe the stuff that's slow is actually all the things that you really care about just working the way that they do. So, I don't know. I'm going to upset people by the comments I've made.
No. Don't worry about that.
I'm extremely pleased to see, you know, what has been in front of everyone else, you know, for the last few years. And I've only recently sort of rejoined this community after a while.
To me, it's amazing that it works at all, Noster. And that it exists at all in that sense. Like, because not too long ago, we didn't have anything. We didn't have, a public square. Twitter was the best, but owned by a private company.
Like, yeah.
Basically, with all the issues that come with that.
Yeah, and all the good issues and the bad issues, you know. Yeah. You could use Twitter for free.
Yeah.
Because somebody else is paying the bills.
Yeah.
And now you can use Noster for free because somebody else is paying the bills, but the bills are really small. You know, it's like running a Noster relay is not that expensive.
Yeah. I think to your comment about the long tail, we went through that with the printing press as well, and books and music and so on, right? Like it's a similar issue where it's just like anyone can produce anything and then you just have to make sense of it after the fact. Now we just have it with software and those kind of things as well.
It is funny because you bring up the music analogy. And you think back, well, you know, all the great classical music that we remember, you know, we only remember the really good ones that survived 200 years.
Yeah.
You know, there was just as much, what we would call vibe slop today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There was just a guy at the corner with like a fiddle, doing whatever.
And you just don't know, none of that went down in history. Yeah. It's kind of like you look at these buildings that are, you know, still standing after 2,000 years, and you're like, wow, what kind of architecture is that? But you don't see all the other buildings that collapsed.
Yeah, of course.
You know, back then. So, it's kind of a survivor bias.
Yeah.
And it's the same in Noster. You know, you see the sausage in the making.
Yeah.
But do you remember the stuff that was, you know, at the beginning of, well, I guess it's only been 4 years. But, you know, the stuff 4 years ago that, like, was a flash in the pan and was never seen
again. Yeah, sure. The early clients there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for all I know, in 2 years, people are going to say, what was that Phipps thing again? You know.
We'll see about it.
I really didn't do Phipps with, like, the strong idea that I was going to go build something that would last for generations. You know, it was, you know, to scratch an itch.
See if I could solve it.
And I mean, I think I solved it pretty well.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll go on record saying that. But, you know, I could be proven wrong. We have this demo day tomorrow, the last one of the cohort. And I have a feeling that several of the demos are going to be people breaking Phipps.
Okay.
We'll see what happens.
We'll see.
But, you know, there's just been like these little rumor mills like, yeah, he's working on something, but he's not going to tell me until he gets to show off, you know, in front of the group that, hey, I broke Phipps. You know, and I'll be humbled.
Let's see what happens. I have one last question for you. Regarding the tools that you mentioned the agentic tools as well. How do you think about it right now? And what did you use to build Phipps in terms of agentic tooling and LLMs and so on?
So there's a couple of questions that are obviously related. So for Phipps, I mean, I'm a huge Claude Code user, and I will freely say that Cloud Code has been part of the both the design and the implementation of FIPS from the beginning. I've been using agentic tools for about a year. They're quite good, especially in the last like 4 months even.
Yeah.
You know, you can see the increase in productivity they give you. My main issue with agentic coding is that it doesn't replace the need for engineering design. Mm. And people tend to blame their tool instead of themselves. Mm. And I mean, I'll say, like,
it's easier to blame someone else.
Claude wrote 99% of FIPS.
Yeah.
But I've reviewed every single file, every line of code. I spent about 2 months iterating with Claude on a design for it, about how the protocol worked, the different layers, how they interact, the corner cases and all of that. And I had, you know, 30,000 words of documentation about the design before I wrote any code. And then writing the code became easy because all the ambiguity was gone, you know, and it was like it had all clear instructions on how to do everything.
So you did lots of rubber duck debugging with Claude.
Oh yeah, very much so.
To writing code.
You know, and that's the same thing that traditional software developers do. Yeah. So that hasn't changed. It's just become much easier, much faster to do. And I have people, you know, I hear overhear people say, you know, I use Claude for this, or my agent broke this, or whatever. And, you know, you don't blame your spreadsheet. You don't blame your compiler. Mm. You don't say, you know, my linter did this. Yeah. You just say, I did this.
Yeah, so why are you blaming the random number generator?
Yeah. You know, so LLMs, I think, are an extremely powerful tool. Yeah,
obviously.
And they've sort of unlocked a huge amount of, you know, like every shower thought you've had for the last 30 years, you're going to go try to make it work. At least that's the case for me.
Yeah.
But they're a tool in your toolbox or tool chest of things to use to solve a problem. But it doesn't change the fundamental calculus of know the problem you're trying to solve, design a solution, remove all the ambiguity from it to get, you know, an implementation plan that you know is going to make it do this. And then at that point, the coding just writes itself. It's like compiling code now. You're compiling ideas to source code, but you got to have all the ideas right first. And then the source code gets compiled down to machine code and all that. We've gone up a layer.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, you're not writing the code, Claude is, or Codex or whatever you happen to be using. But if you want it to work well, you have to write it correct. You have to write the idea correctly now. Just like with a compiler, you have to write the code correctly for it to compile successfully. And I guess that's the analogy. I think pretty much all of the pull requests I've gotten in FIPS, which have all been, well, mostly have been pretty good, I think they've all been written by Claude.
Yeah.
You know, and some of my reviews have been written by Claude.
Yeah.
You know, well, I mean...
You mentioned that because we talked about drive-by pull requests and how do you deal with slop and you were like, you just sent the slop back.
You match effort for effort.
Yeah.
If somebody throws a pull request that was clearly the output of their tooling with no... You see no evidence of, like, review or editing or their own words anywhere in it, I'm just going to say, hey, Claude, do a review and post it. I'm not even going to look at it. And I'm not going to look at what Claude says. You know, I'll just say, you know, it's going to address, you know, a bunch of stuff that you'll go back and have your Claude address and all that. If someone takes the time to use it as a tool and say, here's my pull request, here's what I'm trying to solve, here's the problem, you know, and you can tell that they are involved, then that's a high-value pull request. And you might figure out a bug and a solution to it in a few hours that might have taken weeks. And that's the value of the LLM. We have had a little bit of a problem with, you know, just agents, like, seemingly unknowing to their owner, posting issues on the repo. And you're this is completely out of context. Sometimes even on unrelated issues, you know, they'll post a comment that's like, it has nothing to do with, you know.
Yeah.
But in any case.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, I'm very pro agentic coding, but you have to own it, and it doesn't replace actual engineering.
Yeah. It doesn't replace human thought.
Yeah.
Yet, at least. We'll see about that.
Well, yeah. Now, maybe a year from now, it really will be, you know, Claude, make me a sandwich.
And, yeah.
You know, and there's a sandwich, you know.
Yeah.
But, The agentic tools let you talk to the tool at the speed of your own thought, which is really good because you can iterate quickly, and you don't have to spend a week translating a single thought of yours into code to test it. You know, you can think like you're talking to another person, like we're talking.
I think you know, that's also what makes it so addicting, because you can stay in the flow, in the zone, basically, and just go back and forth. You don't have to wait for whatever, another team to come back to you with feedback or what have you, and all those kind of things. But I think that's what's interesting. It's also, I mean, you know, it's a double-edged sword, because they kind of work like slot machines as well, where you prompt something in and it's very exciting what will come back, and then you stay on it forever, and you just it can be very addicting.
I mean, you can tell some people are like that, you know, like
it's where AI psychosis comes from. You're up all night prompting.
and if you ask them, well, how does this work? They're like, well, let me go ask Claude what he did. Yeah, you know, it's like, well. If you haven't reviewed the output, then
it could be
anything.
Yeah,
it could
it's definitely a double-edged sword, because the evidence is clear that LLM use for students, for example, it will make you, on average, it will make you dumber. I think there is a way to use them that actually helps and assists in learning and makes you learn faster.
But it takes
discipline, right?
I think it takes a teacher, you know, a human teacher, you know, in the case of students, to help direct them on how to use the tooling. Yeah. But the teachers are learning at the same time. I mean, this is new to everybody.
Yeah, it's absolutely new for everyone.
But my final snarky comment on it is agentic tools will make bad programmers worse. It'll make good programmers non-productive.
Yeah.
Or good program. Oh, that sounded bad. Yeah. It'll make good programmers more productive. And it will allow non-programmers to actually program for the first time.
Yeah.
And we've had one attendee here at SEC who has never programmed before, but they were able to design a solution for something that, you know, was within the spirit of how SEC, you know, works. And, you know, it worked well and everything, and it was just an incredible use of, or extension of somebody, I want a solution to exist, I don't know how to do it because I've never coded before. But this person was able to use the tool to create the solution, and it actually worked. And you know, there you can see that, you know, it was iterative, and you know, they fixed things that they didn't like, and you know, so it wasn't just random output. It was,
you have to sit with it and iterate. And
you know, and that has never been possible before. You know, to have never coded, but have a crystal clear idea of what you want to exist, and to be able to translate that through LLMs.
Yeah, no, awesome. I promised you to keep it short, so I have one final, may you give one final piece of advice to the younglings out there? What have you learned from your early cypherpunk days and your early Bitcoin days that might be useful for the, you know, 20-somethings that might be listening to this, that don't have your experience and your build-up wisdom?
Let me think about this for a minute before it gets committed to tape.
Take all the time you need.
I'd say don't be afraid of going your own way. There's a tremendous inertia in the world that is pushing you to turn the crank, to conform, to act within the system. And, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, going off and doing crazy things. I'm talking about your own mind and your own ability to think and to make judgment calls about how the world works will lead you to more success than just believing what you've been taught. And, you know, your parents raised you in a way that was the best way they knew how, but they filled you with information that will only get you so far. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it'll run out. And eventually you get to the point where you're like, wait a minute, that's not how the world works. And the ability to have confidence in your own ability to look, take a fresh look at how things are, will go a very long way in helping you not to, you know, struggle against that feeling like, I know it's not right, but I'm going to, like, do things the way I'm supposed to, and I'm going to, you know, the fiat world, so to speak. Mm. You know, when you're that age, you know, you can do anything. You get my age and you've kind of set your place in the world, and it's kind of hard to change. You know, so don't be afraid to dissent. Mm. And don't be afraid to say, you know what, I'm going to go try doing it this way instead of the way that, you know.
And walk your own way.
Yeah,
Make your own path.
It's very cliche, but it's very real, and it's probably more relevant today than ever. There's a layer of conformity that's pushed upon you constantly, every day, and stop scrolling and start doing stuff. And
that's the thing about cliches, right? The older you get, the truer they become.
Yeah, that's true. I should take my own advice.
All right, that was awesome. I hope you had fun as well. We always end on the hug. May I?
Sure.
Thanks so much for doing all this, building all of it, being here, coming here.
It's been wonderful.
And I'm glad we pulled you out of retirement. Yeah. So
now I have 10 more years of supporting FIPS before I can retire again.
It's going to be fine. The younglings will step up eventually.
They absolutely will.
All right. Thanks so much.